Yesterday. Good, yeah? So you're experts on Sumer and Abraham or Abram. So that hopefully will make even more sense as we get into his life. Probably not till next week, but we'll see. So yeah, good stuff. I'm glad you're getting some good time with him. How's anatomy going with Jared? Good, okay. In Romans with Shay? Acts, sorry. Just making sure you guys are on the same page. Yeah. Sorry, I'm really excited about Romans. Acts, yes. How far are you guys along? Awesome. Theme verse of Acts is Acts. Very good. Okay, you guys will need to know that. Good stuff. Well, I missed you guys yesterday. Actually, that's a lie. I didn't miss you at all. I was in Tahoe with my wife, so I didn't even think about you guys. So other than when I rolled over at 4:30 and went, I'm going back to bed. Thank you, Rick. So, yes, had a mini vacation with my bride, which was good. So let's do this. Let's do some Proverbs, and then we'll get into some Genesis, and we'll go from there. Sound good? Proverbs 12:9. Let's go there today. This is a good one. I feel bad saying there's a good one because that implies that there's not good ones, which maybe the not good ones are just ones that I don't understand. So maybe someday God will enlighten me. 12:9 is a favorite of mine. Somebody read 12:9 from an NASB, please. Okay, better is he who is lightly esteemed and has a servant, is the NASB's translation. Jane, give me NIV on that one. Let me see, is any different?
Yeah, better to be a nobody and yet have a servant than pretend to be somebody and have
no. Okay. I don't know, can't remember if there's a translation that doesn't say has a servant but is a servant. Has anyone gotten that? Okay, so there's two different ways to look at this, and I think the ones we just read are right. Better is he who is lightly esteemed and has a servant. Okay, so we're talking about one type of person, lightly esteemed and has a servant, as opposed to type B person who honors himself, right, and lacks bread. What's the distinction here? What, if you were to characterize these two individuals, what would they look like? What are we talking about? What is person A? Lightly esteemed, yet has a servant. Lightly esteemed by who? Everyone around him, right? He's not impressive to anyone around him, but what does he have? A servant, which means what? He's got money. So he has help, he's made it somewhere in life, right? And he has a servant. So he's at a certain elevation in life, which at this point for him is impressive. He has a servant. But to those around him, how is he viewed? Nobody cares. Like, he's not esteemed in their eyes. However, person B, he who honors himself, how is he viewed amongst other people? Or how is he attempting to be viewed amongst other people? He's pointing to the name on the back of his jersey. Look at me, okay? But what does he not have? Not only does he not have a servant, what does he not have? Dinner, right? He doesn't have bread. Now, he wants to be really important in front of people around him, but he doesn't have anything of substance, okay? In Texas, the saying would say, that person's all hat and no cattle. Okay, they look really impressive on the outside, right? But on the inside, when it comes down to it, they're nothing. Okay, we would call those types of individuals posers. Okay, when I was in fifth grade, I was committed to be a skater, right? I fell in love with like Tony Hawk and the whole skate scene. And, you know, for those of you guys that have been around long enough, you know, Tony Hawk's like legendary. He's a big deal. And there's a whole bunch of other people that have fallen by the wayside. Anyway, but I was totally into the scene, right? The problem was I was terrible. I mean, absolutely god-awful terrible. However, I looked really impressive. I bought all the right gear. I had the right deck. I had the right trucks. I had the right wheels. I had all the right clothing, except when it came to skating. That was my problem. So I looked great on the outside, but when it came down to it, I was terrible, okay? We've seen people like that, right? And that's what this proverb is getting at, is the folks that are trying to point to themselves and to be esteemed amongst other people, and yet don't have the qualities necessary to exemplify that fact. We never honor that, right? We never say, man, isn't that impressive? But the flip side we do, right? I came from a church in Texas, had two elders, okay? One of the guys on the elder board was just a fascinating guy. Okay, wore Levi's, drove a Ford pickup. He was a gazillionaire, right? He was driving home one day from Kansas or something and saw 1,400 acres in Oklahoma. Stopped and bought them. 1,400 acres. Just was like, yeah. And he's like, I'll tell my wife later. How do you buy 1,400 acres, right? Just, yeah, here we go. That looks good to me. I'm going to buy it. He was talking about going skiing with his family, right? And was got tired of the whole rigmarole of like commercial airlines. So he bought a plane. He just bought his own plane, okay? And flies wherever he goes now. So now when they go to Vail, he doesn't have to mess with American Airlines. He just calls his pilot and says, we're going to be there in like 2 hours. So fuel up the jet and we're going to Vail to ski for a couple days or whatever, right? But on the outside, you wouldn't know that about him. He's not flashy. He wasn't one of those guys. I mean, other than buying an airplane. He wasn't flashy. He didn't need everyone else to acknowledge that about him. He was simple. And if you were around him and you walked into Starbucks, that guy wouldn't look a lick different than anybody else, okay? He had a servant, but was lightly esteemed amongst those around him. He had a job that he did very, very well. He got compensated very handsomely for it, but didn't really care. And when you see those two types of individuals, you never praise the person that says, man, I see that that guy's actually a nobody, but because he's trying to be a somebody and is camouflaging himself, well, isn't that like noteworthy? But for someone that has the means to do whatever they want and they choose not to, you say that's an awesome quality, right? So, lesson for us is, it's better to be lightly esteemed, right? And have a servant. So great, if you've got means and God has given you things, man, that's a great quality to have, it's great stuff. But you don't need recognition from the world around you, okay? The flip side is also true, and for any of us that have been through junior high, right, you're aware of that deal, of the look and the external and the qualities and the brand name of jeans that you need to wear and whatever it may be. We've all been down that road so that we can fit in and try to be somebody that we're not. It's not a praiseworthy quality in Scripture, nor is it praiseworthy when you see it in any other walk of life, okay? So as I'm guilty of it and have been guilty of it and continue to be guilty of trying to do those things in life, it's not something that we should chase after, okay? So remember that. Better to be lightly esteemed and have a servant than he who honors himself and yet can't figure out how he's going to eat dinner, okay? So thoughts on that. Right.
They live on less.
Right. Yep.
Versus if you go to the high income houses, like 7 out of 10 of them are deeply in debt and money about their mortgage.
Right. Yeah. Interesting paradigm, right? So, yeah. And someone figured out along the way, I don't need the praise of man to, you know, and I can live underneath my means. And so, yep, that's good. Okay, Mas. Good. All right. You guys ready for some more Genesis? All right. So let's see if we can kind of fast forward through here, get to where you guys left off yesterday, hopefully put some pieces together. We finished at the flood, or prior to the flood, I should say, dealing with the Nephilim. You guys remember that last week, the crazy giants, offspring of fallen angels and daughters of men, bizarro chapter. So as if there hasn't been enough crazy in this book so far. We're 6 chapters into it and it's nuts. So somebody pray for us, and then we will we'll dive into Genesis 6. Who shall pray? And Sally, you look like you want to pray.
Thank you, Lord, for having us all here together. I pray that we come with an open heart and an open mind, and that every single time we come in and gather to hear your word, we fall deeper and deeper in love with you.
Amen. Like it. That was good. I'm just going to stop there. I don't know if you had more, but that was so good. I'm done. It was excellent. Thank you. All right. So Genesis 6. All right. So we finished off, what, verse 7, 8-ish. We saw that in the midst of all that's going on the earth, Noah found favor in the eyes of God. That word was Chen. We talked about that a little bit. Speaking of Chen, where's Chris?
He's in San Jose.
Perfect. That's right. Okay. He told me that. He asked me afterwards what the meaning of Chen was. He asked me if it was Chinese. And I said, no, it's Hebrew. He's like, I was kidding. I was like, okay. Man, it's not funny, dude. It's too early in the morning to be joking like that. Anyway, who else is missing? Anybody? Is that it? Just and Jessica. Okay, cool. And Jacob told me he's gone. Okay, sorry. I get lonely. You guys aren't all here. It's sad. Right here. Perfect. All right. Good, good, good. All right, so let's pick up verse 9. Okay, let's watch Noah. Okay, this is an interesting commentary about this guy. Read that. 6:9. What does that mean, that he was blameless in his time? Was Noah perfect? No. Like, what's the first thing he does when he gets off the boat here in a couple chapters? He gets hammered, right? So he's not perfect, okay? He's got issues. But the idea is, man, he found favor with God because he walks with God. So in the midst of a perverse generation, here is a guy from the line of Shem. That means, Seth. Shem's coming. That's one of his sons, so he's not from his son, obviously. Order of operations, really important there. It's like when Madison tells me I look like her. I'm like, no, you look like me. So just trust me. We'll explain all that later. But that's the idea. So he's a righteous man walking with God, not perfect, but God finds favor with him. And not just him, you'll see his sons are going to be included in the benefit, as will his daughters-in-law be that's coming with the flood. Okay. Now the problem with the earth is verse 11. Read that.
Now the earth is corrupt in God's sight. The earth is filled with violence.
Okay, God looks at the earth in verse 12 and says, man, we got to do something about this. Verse 13, the end of all flesh has come before me. The earth is filled with violence because of them. And behold, I am about to destroy them with the earth. So because of chapter 6, verses 1 through 4-ish, God is grieved over the state of humanity. They're unconstrained in their ability to do evil. And God says, man, this 6:1-4 is the example. This is the worst case scenario, right? It is bad, so we're going to hit the do-over button. Okay, and that's what God's about to do. However, he feels a sense of compassion for Noah, his family, humanity. God doesn't regret that he created humanity, but he feels a deep sense of real sorrow of what's happened here. Okay, so that's kind of the wordplay. So God does indeed feel very deeply, and he's going to call Noah to do something that you guys know about. 14, let's pick up there. Okay, so he's called to make an ark. Now remember, we haven't seen rain on the earth ever. Okay, it has not rained. He's called to make a boat in a landlocked country. Okay, so this had to be a very interesting, to those around him, you can imagine Noah looked like a typical religious, charismatic nut job. I mean, that's what Noah was, right? So, God told me to. Oh, did he really? And it's going to what? It's going to rain? What's rain, Noah? Right? You can just imagine the conversations that these people are having about Noah. Okay. My translation, verse 14, says gopher wood, cypress. We're not sure exactly what type of wood he uses, but he uses what was there. There's a really bad Bible joke, gopher wood, because Noah just had to gopher wood, gopher wood, gopher wood. Sorry, bad. I told you it's bad. So don't ever repeat that, and don't quote me if you do, okay? But that's the idea. Pitch would be something that was in between the wood that he used to seal the cracks with. So he's going to make a watertight vessel of some sort, and we're going to get the dimensions in verse 15 and following. So this is what God's going to have this guy make.
This is how you are to make it. The length of the ark, 300 cubits, its breadth, 50 cubits, and its height, 30 cubits.
Okay, what's a cubit? Biblically, where did we get that measurement from? It's the length between your elbow and your wrist, okay? 18 inches. Okay, that's the modern day equivalent. Okay, so since you guys don't speak cubits, okay, we're looking at a boat that's 450 feet long, okay, 75 feet wide and 45 feet high. Okay, 450 feet long. Okay, a football field is how long? 300 feet. 100 yards, 300 feet. Okay, that's big. So 450 feet. We're talking about a football field and a half of a boat. Okay, a normal football field is 50 yards wide, okay? So just to give you an idea, this is 75 feet wide and 45 feet tall. So this is a pretty impressive vessel, okay, in terms of its size. We'll talk about it here in a second, but capacity of that would be about 1.4 million cubic feet. Okay, so just make a note of that. It's for fun. You're not going to need it on the test, but just something to think about here in a second when we talk about what Noah has to put on said boat. Okay. Verse 16, you shall make a window for the ark, finish it with a cubit from the top, set a door inside the ark, and you shall make it with the lower, second, and third decks. We've got three decks, okay? Probably one for food, probably one for supplies, one for animals, one for what animals leave over after they've eaten food, okay? So that's multiple decks for himself, and the people, for the animals, for supplies, and so on and so forth, okay? That's it. Okay, there's your boat building process. Okay, make a big boat, make it this big, give it a window. Okay, I mean, for those of you guys that know a little bit about boating, what else would you want on this boat that Noah doesn't get? How about a rudder? How about the ability to control boat in water? God says, no, you don't need that. Okay, he basically says, Noah, make a ginormous coffin. Okay, with a window on the top, and make sure it's watertight. Like, okay. And at the very, very top, you get to peek out, right, and see what's going on around you. Oh, it's still raining. Awesome. Hey, there's water everywhere, right? That's what he builds, okay? It's a ginormous coffin, okay, that floats. The idea is God's in control of this thing. He's going to bring it where he wants, and he's going to, well, we're going to see the story, but that's kind of the picture. So it's a very simple boat. I am told from folks that are a little bit more seafaring than I am that in terms of the dimensions of the boat, this would have been a phenomenal it would have been darn near unsinkable because of the way it was built and the size. It would have been able to handle waves and so forth. Okay, so it's imagine that God's a good designer. Can you believe that He made the earth and knows how to build boats too? Okay, all right. So he tells him, verse 17, I'm about to bring a flood. Okay, it's coming. But verse 18, here's what I'm going to do first. Okay, verse 19, you're going to bring in every living thing. Verse 17, everything that isn't in there is going to die, but you and your sons, your daughters-in-law, they're going to get to come on the boat. And verse 18, I'm going to establish my covenant with you. It's the first time we've seen this actual word. Okay, we've seen the idea of covenant before, and we'll rewind the tapes here in a little bit next week, and I'll show you a couple covenants that we've already seen in Scripture. We just didn't cover them. God is going to talk about this idea, and this is a theme throughout your Old Testament of a picture, okay? God says, I'm going to establish a covenant with you, okay? It's an interesting word. It literally means, it has the root meaning of the word to cut, okay? To cut a covenant, and we're going to see kind of the word picture of that as we get into Genesis 12 and following, this word picture. It's a very, very powerful word. There's several different types of covenants in Scripture, two primary. And we'll talk about those again primarily with Abraham, and we'll walk through kind of this formal idea, okay? But God's going to establish something with Noah. It's a promise. It's a guarantee, okay? A covenant. And then we'll talk through that again more in detail, okay? Verse 19, you're going to bring two of everything in the ark, okay? You guys know this story. Verse 20, birds, animals, every creeping thing after their kind, two of every kind shall come to you, and you're going to keep them alive, okay? So, you've heard the story, you sung the songs. So God is going to draw to the ark two of every kind. Notice that, by the way, in verse 20. How does Noah go out and get the animals? Or how do the animals get onto the ark, would be better said? Is he chasing like mama bear and daddy bear down, you know, to wrangle them and get them in the boat? They are drawn to the ark, okay? So apparently the unicorns were just very, very fast, and he could not catch them, okay? So that's why we don't have unicorns anymore. So that's the idea. So, by the way, there's a really cool picture with the Ark of Salvation. Okay, kind of mirror images that. I don't know that God wrote it for that, but it's interesting just to kind of look at it. There is a divine vessel that God builds. There is one way in. You are drawn to that by God. And if you are not in it, everything outside of that will receive judgment. If you are in there, you are safe. You are removed from judgment. And God provides for those that are His. Okay, so that's kind of the picture. All right. Now, we'll see this again, and we've seen it before. Noah brings two of every kind into the ark, okay? When we say kind, we do not mean the same thing that scientists mean by the word species, okay? Noah is told to build kind. Species is kind of a loose term. Kind is even a little bit looser. But a kind would be anything that can reproduce with another kind, okay? So, for instance, I have a Maltipoo at home. Okay, we just bought it. Okay, it is a Maltese and a poodle. Okay, in scientific language, it's not a dog, it's a large rat. Okay, but it falls underneath the category of dog somehow. It's cute. A poodle and a Maltese are two different species, correct? But they can interbreed, right? And they form a Maltipoo, right? Oh, how about that, okay? Those are the same kind. Okay, kind is even wider than that, okay? A coyote, a dingo, and a dog can all interbreed. They are all in the same kind, though they are not the same species, okay? So as we talk about how many animals Noah had to bring on the boat, he had to bring kinds, not species, okay? So he doesn't need a golden retriever and a lab, and a dingo, and he needs one of every kind that can ultimately interbreed to make more sub-kinds, species, whatever you want to call them, okay? So to give you an idea, today there are 18,000 kinds of animals, more or less, okay? 18,000, we would say, that can interbreed that would be unique to their kind, okay? Just for fun, if you double that number and say, well, in Noah's day, how many kinds were there? Well, we've got T-Rex and whatever else that we don't have around today. Let's double that and say it was 36,000 kinds, okay? You with me? 18,000 today, 36,000 kinds. Noah has to bring two, right? So 36 takes us now to 72,000 kinds Noah has to bring upon the boat. You with me? In 7 and following, we're going to see God say, hey, you need to bring some sacrifices as well. Okay, so there's going to be more kinds that are coming. In verses 2, 3, 4, when they get off the boat, Noah's going to kill these animals for sacrifice. Okay, so let's say we're looking at 75,000 kinds of animals, okay, male and female, that Noah has to bring on the boat. Based on today's shipping estimates, on that size boat, a 1.4 million cubic foot boat, we could take 125,000 sheep, okay? Noah just has to bring 75,000, okay? So this vessel, would have been very, very possible to bring this many animals on it, okay? Plus food, plus sustenance, whatever they need. We're going to find out they're going to be on the boat for 377 days, I think it is total, okay? So just over a year, they're going to get on this boat, okay? 377 days. 125,000. Yeah, 377 days on the boat, okay? So, now, obviously, you've got other issues that we got to solve, but yes. They are. Okay, but how? All right, think creatively. How do you solve that problem? We got to get a T-Rex on board. Now, remember, they're all herbivores, so nobody's eating anybody, okay? So that's not an issue. Thank you. How about we get a baby? Do I have to get an adult T-Rex? No. Can I get a baby T-Rex? Absolutely. Okay. So some animals are obviously bigger, right? Not all animals are sheep size. Okay. But my Maltipoo, you know, that's like 1/90th of a sheep, right? So especially when they're a puppy, he literally, like, you know, a newborn cat would have eaten him alive. So you kind of get the idea, okay? So if we take sheep as kind of the average size animal that would have been on the ark, there's plenty of room, okay? So if they brought juveniles, okay, babies or even younger animals that aren't full grown, they're only on the boat for a year, okay? So they're going to grow, but that's kind of the idea, okay? So you with me? So just fun numbers. I grew up with golden retrievers and labs, so I have 4 women in my house. Enough said. So I lost that battle. Labs are dogs. Maltipoos are something other. They're a different kind. Chapter 7, verse 1. Let's pick up there before I get in any trouble. My wife listens to this. You will deny this if my wife says I said anything bad about our dog. No, he loves Tucker. All right, 7:1. Somebody pick up there. All right, so God's going to call Noah again in 21 and 22 of chapter 6, bring in food for you, for the animals that you're bringing on board. Because of your righteousness, because I have found favor with you, Noah, you get to come on. 2 and 3 are more things that are going to come. The sacrifices that we mentioned that Noah has to bring on board for afterwards. And then watch what happens in verse 4. So Noah's got to get on the boat, and then watch what God does. All right, so Noah's got to get on the boat, and then what? For a week, he has to sit on the boat. Like, what are people doing, right? They're probably in their lawn chairs, just, like, laughing at Noah, hanging out. Hey, Noah, nice boat. You wonder if God was very intentional about that. Like, obviously he was, but why, right? Is he testing Noah's faith, you know, testing his belief in what God said? Like, okay, you got to sit here for a week and be humiliated by everyone around you, and then I will bring rain, okay? For 40 days and 40 nights, all right? Noah did, verse 5, according to all that the Lord had commanded. Noah was 600 years old when the flood came upon the earth. According to verse 6, Noah and his sons' wives were with him, and he entered the ark. I think there's 10 total. He and his wife, eight. He and his wife, three kids, three wives of kids, okay, daughters-in-law, okay? Verse 11, pick up there, 7:11. So how do we get rain that is going to cover the entire earth? See also Genesis 1. What happened in verse 11? The vapor canopy is gone. So God just dropped a bunch of water on the earth. And that's going to take a process of over 40 days and 40 nights. We're going to see somewhere. There's like 150 days of continual rain before God relinquishes it. So it doesn't all come at once, but God takes his pin and pokes a hole in the vapor canopy, and man, it's coming. So it dumps. So if you took rain, I think all the water on the earth today, it would cover like, I forget, it's some ridiculous amount of like 3 feet of the entire earth, right? So you're not going to cover Everest with the amount of rain that would come from the oceans and so forth, okay? So not possible. But if you've got a vapor canopy full of water, that makes it possible. So that's the idea. So whatever God had created above the world to create this incredible environment, that is now gone. So our greenhouse is gone, and we've got rain that's covered the earth. Rain fell, verse 12, for 40 days and 40 nights, just like God said, okay? Noah and his wives, verse 13, not wives, his sons and his sons' wives. We only have one at this point for Noah. That's good. Okay, we're going to see a problem with that later, but not yet. All the beasts of the field, everything that was supposed to be on there is on there. Verse 16, those entered, male and female. He entered as God commanded them, and the Lord closed the door behind them. So they are all on there, save. This is kind of the process upon which they get on the ark. Verse 21, let's watch what happens to those outside the ark, 21 and 22. Melissa, pick up there, if you will, 22. Or 21, 22.
And all flesh died, that
I meant the other one, but you're Mo, so I'm trying to distinguish here. So, but keep going, you're doing fantastic. We'll let the other Melissa read shortly. So how many escape judgment? None. Okay, so if you're not on the boat, you're dead. Okay, so what do we now have a world of? I mean, we got death everywhere. We have literally floating carcasses that are filling the earth now. Don't know what the population of the earth was at that point. You take man, you take animals. I mean, it's a lot of death, right? So not a good thing. Verse 23, he blotted out every living creature that was upon the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things into the birds of the sky. He blotted them out. Only Noah was left together with those that were with him on the ark. Okay, sorry, I just thought of something. When we talk about kinds, the 18,000 kinds, that would have been of land animals. So it's possible for insects and things like that, that maybe they could have survived outside the ark, potentially. So as we talk about kinds in general, there may have been some insects particular that could have survived outside the ark. Maybe they didn't need to come on board. So there would have been more kinds than that if we took the entire scope of all animals. So just so that I'm clear on those crazy numbers. Yeah, somehow, obviously. So, and I don't know how God handled that. So that's the assumption of why maybe it was just land animals that needed to come on, because fish would have been like, great, my environment just got bigger, right? So that's not bad for them. And potentially, obviously, animals that can fly would have been, you know, birds came on, but others maybe could have survived outside the ark. So who knows? I wasn't there. But you can ask God when you get to heaven. Or ask Ronan when we get to Israel. He knows the answers to all things. Cool? You with me? So there we are. Okay. Verse 24, the water prevailed upon the earth 150 days. Okay, so we're going to see something's going to happen now at day 150-ish that God's going to ask Noah to do. Okay, watch what God does in the midst of this. 8:1. Probably. Imagine that picture, right? Like, oh, Noah's not an idiot. Like, oh, we laughed at you. Oh, judgment's coming, right? And here it is. So it's a scary thought, right? Again, you compare the parallels to salvation. There's talk about, in 2 Peter, they talk about Noah and people just mocking the idea of judgment. I think judgment's not coming because judgment is delayed. Well, it's not here now, so it must not be coming at all. This judgment thing that you speak of must be... There's no God, right? There is no judgment. So it's been 2,000 years, you know, whatever. It's not happening. And then all of a sudden it comes. People go, oh, at that point it's too late. So, yeah. So it's a hard picture. But God's going to warn them. And he's giving us pictures of, listen, when I say judgment's coming, it's coming. And I've done it throughout history. So when I tell you there's a coming judgment in Revelation, and just because it hasn't come yet doesn't mean it's not coming. It means I am patient and forbearing, and I've withheld judgment so that more may come to me, but one day it's going to come. So, hard reality, but that's, yeah. So, Raven, that to answer your question, yes, I'm sure that happened, and it had to be an ugly, ugly day, right? So, tough. So, yeah, floodgates open. Verse 2, you see that again. Water is now becoming restrained. Verse 4, in the 7th month, 17th day of the month, the ark rested upon the mountains of Ararat. Okay, Ararat Mountains would have been like way north of Israel, okay? So like modern day, even north of like Syria. Okay, we'll get into maps and stuff next week. I'll show you some more of that. So we don't know exactly where it landed. This is a chain of mountains that it landed on. That's the best we get. Okay, if you watch the Discovery Channel, somebody found the Ark. Of course, they didn't get it on, you know, TV because they wouldn't show it to them. But there's people that believe they found it and all kinds of funny things that they think they found. But oddly enough, no one can actually see it. So, but they found it. Anyway, so there you go. Welcome to Discovery Channel. Water recedes, okay, and then in verse 6, this is what God asked Noah to do.
And then it came about at the end of the 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made.
Okay, keep going.
And he sent out a raven, and it flew here and there until the water was dried up from the earth.
Okay, so Noah sends out a raven. What type of bird is a raven? Sorry, raven. You're the bad example in this illustration, so maybe not bad, but if you send out a raven and he's got dead carcasses everywhere, what do you call that? It's called a buffet, right? Like, oh, yes, I have my choice of anything I want to eat, okay? They're scavenger birds. They can survive on that sort of thing. So Noah sends out the raven. It says in verse 7 that he flew here and there until the water was dried up from the earth. Does the raven return to the boat? No, because he finds rest out in this area, right? He flies here and there until the water recedes, okay? What is Noah doing, by the way? Why is he sending out birds? Yeah, is there land, right? I need some type of proof that, like, God shut off the floodgates, but all I see is water everywhere, and I can't steer. I don't have any control of this thing. So he sends out a raven and then realizes, that bird's not coming back. So I don't know what Noah was thinking, but there's a really cool picture in that as well. Okay, so he sends out a raven. Raven doesn't return, okay? Not anymore. That's changing. It's about to change. So good observation, though. In chapter 9, we're going to see that change post-flood. Okay, God's going to give the green light to eat meat. Okay, so thank God. Or I would be dead. Verse 8, what does Noah send out now? Dove. What's the difference between a dove and a raven? In terms of diet. Do doves eat flesh? No. Okay, so what is the dove not going to find? He's not going to find rest. He's not going to find food. And ultimately, what is that dove going to have to do? According to verse 9. Returns, comes back to Noah. Okay, interesting enough, anybody know what Noah's name means? We talked about that? Rest. Okay, so the dove found Noah, right? So it comes back to the ark, comes back to the Father, okay? Returns to him, to the ark, for the water had not subsided, okay? Noah's going to send her out again. She's going to come back, or he's going to come back. Don't know if it's a boy or a girl, raven, or a dove, but comes back. And ultimately is going to come back with, verse 11, a freshly picked olive branch. So Noah's going to be aware of, okay, there is now trees, there is growth, so there's land, so we are seeing the waters recede, and now there is hope for us to survive in the midst of this, okay? There's a cool kind of behind-the-scenes picture of, I don't know how you want to paint it, but you guys have heard of the person that's put their faith in God, and then they walk away from their faith, and they leave for a set amount of time. You know, they say, I don't want anything to do with God, I'm unconverted, I'm whatever. And then the picture is always, man, is that person going to return back to the ark or back to God, right? If someone is truly a raven, are they going to return back to the Father? No, because they were never a dove to begin with. They were never one that was one with the Father. They never made a true conversion, okay? If a dove is sent out into the world and stays in the world for a while, can they live there for some amount of time? Yes. Can they live there forever? No, because there's going to be no rest for them, right? I was talking to my brother yesterday. My brother is a opera singer, okay? The guy is stupid gifted. I mean, ridiculous, right? He swam in the deep end of the gene pool in our family, so the guy's amazing, okay? But as a Christian, married to a Christian gal, they're both opera singers, and they're in this crazy weird scene where you travel all over the country and people hire you, and he literally is in, like, Vancouver, and then he's in Europe, and then he's in New York, and then he's in Vegas, and you can imagine the lifestyle of traveling performers and just what comes with that, right? They're human. And he's in a very, very hard, dark environment where there's not a lot of Christians, there's not a lot of support. So he's having a conversation with this guy. Literally just sent me an email yesterday, and this guy and him were having a dialogue, and my brother was like, man, I feel like I need to ask this guy if he's a believer or not. And he does, and says, hey, man, you, based on some things that you posted on Facebook or whatever, and are you a Christian? And he said, no, I used to be. In fact, I'm a pastor's kid. And he wrote this, like, 61-page, like, testimony called The Deconstruction of His Faith. And my brother said, man, I don't know what to do with this. Can you read it? And I'm like, I don't read anything that's doesn't pop up or whatever, but yes, I'll try to read 61 pages. I just assign those to other people. No. So anyway, I started reading this guy's story yesterday, and it's fascinating, right? He's a pastor's kid, which for me, who I'm raising three pastor's kids and not a pastor's kid myself, I have no idea, like, how you screw up a kid really, really good, but I'm, you know, this kid, it happened to, and obviously trying to avoid that. But it's fascinating listening to this kid and his experiences, and this guy is a he's either a dove or a raven, but man, he is off the boat, right? He is like, I'm done. I don't want any part of this. And he talks about his upbringing and his jacked up this and his messed up that and his parents divorced this thing and all this other stuff that happens in his life. And the question will be ultimately, is that kid going to return to the boat? And at the end of the day, we don't know, okay? But he's either a dove or he's a raven. And he's going to find rest in the world and find satisfaction in those things because he is not of the Father, or he's going to say, you know what? I've tried this. You know, I am the prodigal son, and I went and lived and slept with the pigs, and man, it was fun for a season, but this stinks, and I want to come back home to Dad. And he will, if he's one or the other, okay? And Lord willing, my brother will have, you know, a opportunity to come alongside this kid and minister to him in the process and ask good questions and be a friend to him in the midst of, you know, the darkness that he's in as well. So, but I think there's a cool word picture there, okay? So for those of you that have friends like this, you know somebody, you've been that person, right, and, you know, or whatever at some point in your life, ultimately, that's the question. Man, is that person going to find rest? And a true believer, my contention is they're not going to find rest in the world. They're going to be miserable to some degree. You know, sin is fun for a season, but sin does not ultimately bring about pleasure and satisfaction. And there'll be a point where your sin meter or your sin tank is full and your heart is wickedly empty. And you'll go, you know what, I need to come back. And God will draw you back. And he'll allow you to do that for a season, okay? So, anyway, cool word picture, okay? So, he sends out the dove, okay? The second time, the dove comes back with the olive branch. Verse 12, Noah waits another 7 days, sent out another dove, but she did not return because now there is land, now there's a place to be, they can stay. Verse 13, it came about in the 601st year, the first month, the water was dried up from the earth. Noah removed the covering from the ark and looked, and behold, the surface of the ground was dried up. So now we've got land again. Okay, so verse 14, the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dry. So I think in total, 377 days based on my math. You can double check it, but I believe that is correct. Okay? So now Noah says, or God says to Noah, rather, verse 16, get out of the ark, you and your sons, bring everything out with you, okay, that they may breed abundantly upon the earth and be fruitful and multiply. So the same command that we see in the garden, be fruitful and multiply. Now Noah's got to re-subdue the earth, repopulate the earth, so go be fruitful and multiply. Noah and his sons went out, verse 19, all the birds of the air, the flesh, everything is out, and they obey God, okay? Now, verse 20, Noah gets off the boat, watch what happens.
Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offering on the altar.
Okay, so he now takes the animals that he brought with him and offers it as a sacrifice. Okay, the Lord smells the soothing aroma. And the Lord said to himself, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth, and I will never again destroy everything as I have done. Okay, a couple things of note in there. God smells the soothing aroma of burning flesh. Have any of you ever smelled burning flesh? It's foul. It is super foul. Burnt hair or whatever, like, it is not a pleasant smell. Why is it pleasant to God? What does it symbolize? Yeah, obedience to a degree. Certainly from Noah, that's what God told Noah to do, so he's being obedient. What else as we get into the book of Leviticus? Why is that picture so compelling for God? Maybe even back to the garden, Genesis 3:21. Yeah, it's a picture of atonement for sin, right? So there's a sacrifice on Noah's behalf, and that picture of atonement continues to carry through. Now, we haven't seen a commandment for sacrifice yet, okay? That doesn't come to Leviticus, okay? That's way in the future, okay, in terms of time period. But Noah's already doing these things. We saw that again, the idea of sacrifice way with Cain and Abel, you know, a couple chapters ago. So the idea is there, but the ordinance of sacrifice doesn't come until the book of Leviticus, okay, in Exodus as well when we get in there. Okay, so there must have been some type of communication from God that he knew that was normative and desired by God. It just doesn't get formally written down until Moses pens it later in Leviticus. So clearly, there's something there that, you know, no one knew that was the right type of sacrifice. That's what honored God. He probably heard of it with Cain and Abel and realized, oh, okay, God was pleased with one and maybe not with the other, or at least allowed one, and you know, we talked about the heart issue behind those, but so yeah, the idea is clearly there for a sacrifice. So need to see that early on. Okay, now 21, God says, I'm never going to do this again. I'm never going to destroy humankind the way I just did. Okay, which had to be good, because what would happen every time it rained? You would wig out, right? Like, oh dear Lord, like here comes a flood again, right? So you think about it, rain is not a, oh, it's outside, it's raining, and let me get my tea. You know, that was not rain to them. Rain was, we're all going to die, okay? So God says, no, I'm never going to do that again, okay? Did the intent of man's heart, according to verse 21, change? No. Why? Because even though Noah found favor with God, what is still in Noah? It's a thing called a sin nature, right? He still has it. So even though God's going to do some things to restrain evil, okay, but he's not going to, this doesn't fix the problem, okay, so just so that we're kind of all on the same page with that, okay. So God says, I'm never going to do this again. Chapter 9, verse 11, we're going to get to the external sign of that covenant, okay. This is a promise from God, okay, the Noahic covenant, and again, we'll cover this in more detail next week, but that's his promise. I'm not going to destroy the earth, and I will let you know every time it rains as to why I'm not going to, okay. So that's the picture there, okay? So, chapter 9 and following, God blessed Noah in verse 1, says, be fruitful and multiply. And then he does something different. Verse 2, we haven't seen this before. Watch this.
Fear of you and dread of you shall be upon every beast of earth, upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground, and all the fish in the sea. Into your hand they are delivered.
Okay, what happens there between man and animal? Animal fears man. Why is that? Why would God have to create that? Okay, man versus lion. Who wins that battle? Lion. Like, man versus just about anything, we're on the losing side of that battle. We're not faster. We're not stronger. We don't have bigger teeth. We have no great self-defense mechanisms, right? I can't, you know, shoot venom out of my mouth like a snake or eat you alive like a lion or whatever, right? So God has to put the fear of man within the animal realm so that they will graciously leave us alone and not kill us, okay? So that's the idea. So we are the top of the food chain in the sense of that we are the crown of creation, but we are not the most powerful alpha male in the midst of beasts. Okay, you guys with me? So he puts the fear of animals, fear of man within animals. Yes, for sure. Yep, yep. So in a world where he's about to change the game in terms of our diet, this was necessary because we would not have dominion. They would have dominion over us, right? So, okay? Okay. Keep going in verse 3. Pete, pick up there.
Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you, and as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything.
Okay, so what just changed? Yeah, you get to eat meat. You still get to eat vegetables? Absolutely. Knock yourself out if you want to eat those nasty things. That's up to you, okay? I'm teasing. Okay, so now meat's on the menu, okay? So you get to eat meat, okay? Only, verse 4, what can you not eat? Okay, flesh with its life in it. That is its blood, okay? So what's the picture there? What do you have to do to meat before you eat it? You got to cook it, okay? Why? Is God just not a fan of sushi? Why would God say you've got to cook the meat first? There's obviously health reasons, but aside from that.
Blood is like sacred, it's their life.
Absolutely. It's the life of the animal, okay, which is a big deal. And then what else does it symbolize?
Being sacred.
Keep going with me. To God, what does blood mean?
Sacrifice.
Sacrifice, atonement, okay? It's a special symbol, so you're not going to eat that with blood in it, okay? So that's the picture, okay? Atonement is special. Blood is special. Blood means atonement. Blood is a sacrificial picture. So cook the meat first, obviously for a number of reasons this was a good idea, okay? You're not going to get E. coli or, you know, botulism or all the other funky diseases that come from uncooked whatever. So that's the idea. So I used to tease my friend in college. I'm like, see, that's why I don't eat sushi. It's nasty. So, and God doesn't like it either. So if you like sushi, again, knock yourself out, okay? There's some funny, not funny, but like missionaries have to deal with this. You know, in certain cultures in Africa and the like, blood is considered sacred and they drink blood and it's a delicacy. And, you know, we've had missionaries that had to wrestle with, what do I do today? So if I am in their culture and they offer me this, do I obey God and offend them? Do I not offend them and disobey God? Like, so have fun answering that one, okay? Anywho, okay? Now, don't eat flesh with its blood. In verse 5, let's keep going. Pick up in verse 5. Jane, pick up there if you will.
And for your life, blood, I will surely command them to eat. I will demand an accounting from every animal. And from each man, too, I will demand an accounting for the life of his fellow man.
Okay, keep going.
Whoever sheds the blood of man, but man...
Okay, so God says, what's this in 5 and 6? What institution just got created? What is that called? From every man, I will require that life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man, his blood shall be shed.
Eye for an eye.
Eye for an eye. What do we call it today? It's called capital punishment. Does man have the right, given by God, to take another person's life? Yes. Okay, according to verse 6, God says, if you kill another man, then mankind has the right to take that person's life. God gave that right to man, okay? Whoever sheds man's blood, if you kill another man, if you shed a man's blood, by man, his blood shall be shed. So God hands that right to Noah and all that would come after them, and say, that's the idea. Because man is an image bearer of God, obviously we mean mankind, man and woman, okay, applies to both. Both are in the image. If you kill a woman, then by mankind shall that woman's life be taken. Okay, that is called capital punishment. Okay, so tells me in verse 7, be fruitful and multiply. Okay, so capital punishment. Now that ended in the Old Testament, right? Yes or no? No? Oh, you're like, he set me up. I'm not going to answer. I know what he's doing. Don't say anything. Okay, so another proponent for yes. Nobody wants to say no. Curse you all. Turn to Romans chapter 13. Those of you that may have been educated in a high peace, conflict resolution type university in Fresno may have issues with this, okay? Not that I'm naming names, okay? So capital punishment is clearly around in the Old Testament, okay? And we're going to see Paul in Romans 13, okay, talk about government and how government is established, okay? Romans 13, verse 1. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. So according to Paul, where does all government come from? From God, okay? I received hate mail one time when I preached, and it was on this verse, okay? So Paul, who's writing to Rome, who's under whose authority? Who is Rome underneath? Like the Romans, who had the most wicked, obnoxious Caesars that thought they were gods. I mean, you talk about a jacked up government system. See also Rome, and we'll study a whole lot more of that when we get into Israel. Jacked, okay? Paul says that authority to rule Rome's government came from who? God, okay? So, like, we have issues with that today, right? There are plenty of government officials that I would just as soon not be governing our country, okay? But they are, okay? God says that's for me. I allow it to be so. Now, there's a point with all government where if they ask you to disobey God, that's a whole other conversation, and God doesn't go there. But Paul says, listen, those authorities are put in place for a reason. God put them there. Like it or not, he's not asking for our opinion, okay? Therefore, verse 2, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. So if you don't want to obey government, you're going to receive the due rewards of that or the penalty of that, and that's established by God, okay? For rulers, verse 3, are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. So if you do good, do you need to fear government? No. If I drive the speed limit all the way back to my house, do I have any reason to fear police? No. If I drive 70, do I? Absolutely, because I'm doing something wrong, and that's why they're there, to restrain evil, to restrain wrongdoing. For people that don't have enough self-control to control themselves, they're going to help control you, okay? And we all say, thank you, right? I don't want that guy breaking into my house. I want that person to know that there are consequences for crimes and evils and atrocities they're committed. Large or small, there needs to be the fear of government to restrain evil, okay? Some of us are better at restraining ourselves than others for various different reasons, okay? So if you're good, don't sweat it, okay? Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good. And in verse 3, and you will have to praise from the same. So don't worry about it, okay? Verse 4, read that. Okay, God's servant, for it, my translation says, is government. So government is God's minister for you who are good. Okay, but, keep reading.
If you do wrong, be afraid.
Why would you be afraid? Keep going.
For he does not bear the sword for nothing.
Okay, not he, but it, I think, is the right translation. He meaning, or it meaning who? Government does not what?
Bear the sword
for nothing, for it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. What does it mean that the government bears the sword, and if you are evil, you need to fear it? What does government have the ability to do? Take your life. If you take someone's life, does government have the authority from God to take your life? New Testament, absolutely. Do I believe in capital punishment? Yes, because Paul believes in capital punishment, okay? It's right there. Now, I'm not a big fan of it. I don't want to, you know, like express lane. It is not, obviously, it's the last solution, but people need to understand that there are earthly consequences to behavior, okay? Yeah.
What about the whole thing with an eye for an eye?
Yep. Is that still true?
Like, I'm asking it, like,
yeah. Yes, this is what this is saying. It's an eye for an eye. That's exactly the picture, okay? So crime committed should equal penalty. Okay, so if you take life, your life will be taken. Okay, that doesn't mean every crime ends with the sword. It means there's an appropriate consequence to said action. Okay, so it's like with my kids. We try to find appropriate consequences based on if they blow it that fit the crime. Okay, so this is a last resort, but government has that authority from God to do that. Okay, so, okay. Now, you look at Jesus, Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 7. Turn the other cheek. If your neighbor hits you, offer them the other one, right? Those things are obviously still true. One is not necessarily higher than the other, and I think there's tendencies in Scripture to exalt one over the other. I believe all that is true. I believe the Sermon on the Mount. I believe Jesus, okay? And that should be our attitude as Christians, right? To have thick skin, to turn the other cheek, to not pursue those things. But at the end of the day, government has that authority given by God, according to Paul, to take life if necessary. Okay?
He also said those who live by the sword die by the sword. Those who are being taken captive.
I thought about that. So, okay? So just something to chew on. Okay? A lot of, you'll hear a lot that this was maybe just an Old Testament concept. It seems to hold true in the New Testament as well, according to Paul. Okay, we don't get a lot more on it in terms of capital punishment in Scripture, but it seems to be, based on what Paul's saying here, that it's still around, at least with Rome. Okay, and obviously they were you talk about capital punishment and making an example of people, there was no society that was better or worse in terms of how they did it than Rome. Okay, Rome invented crucifixion. They were filthy, and they wanted to make sure everyone knew when somebody died, what that was like. And they didn't crucify people privately. They crucified people at the Save Mart Center and said, everybody come. We're going to do it on the corner of Blackstone and, Blackstone and Shaw. We're going to do it in the middle of the public marketplace so everyone can see it. See what happens when you do that? That's what happens when you do that. People went, oh, okay, maybe I shouldn't do that. That was the idea.
How did Moses feel ready this in Genesis?
Yeah. It's a great question. So yeah, this is, you know, obviously way after the fact for him, but yeah, I don't know.
If I was back, you know, I would have read this and be like, you know, it didn't come from that. So
yeah. Yeah, right? Yeah, it's an interesting perspective, Pete, when you think about Moses, who was a murderer. Oh gosh. Yeah. Are you sure about that, God? Because there's a small little issue in my past that we need to discuss, right? Here's a sacrifice. So, yeah, that's a great observation, okay? So, that's the idea, okay? So, God takes the image-bearing of humanity with great seriousness, okay? And the reason why, according to, back to Genesis chapter 9, verse 6, is because we are made in the image of God. So, is that image still around post-flood? Yes. Has it changed? Yeah, it's marred, okay? It's scarred. It's defaced but not erased is what my theological-minded professor used to say. And I think that's right on. We are still image bearers. That image is not the exact same as it was with Adam because there's now sin and a taintedness to who we are. But we are still very much the image bearers of God and uniquely so. Okay? No other animal has that privilege or right. Okay? With me? All right. So, verse 11 of chapter 9. Let's watch now what God's going to establish as a reminder that he is not going to destroy the earth again in the same way. Okay, so does God promise not to destroy the earth again? No. He says, I'm never going to destroy it by a what? Flood. Because we know in Revelation, God's going to destroy the earth. It's not with a flood, but he will destroy the earth again. Okay? And here is the sign of how you'll, you know, not wig out every time it rains. Verse 12, pick up there. Okay, so bow or bow. Okay, in this case, bow. That's quite all right. Spell the same. English is a weird language, right? Wind, wine, which one is it? I don't know. I mean, it's, yeah. So, anywho, rant for another day, okay? He's going to set his bow in the cloud. What is a bow? Yeah, rainbow in this context, but a bow is an offensive weapon of war. And he says, I'm going to set my bow down, okay? I'm going to put my bow in the clouds. So the sign of the Noahic covenant is what? Rainbow, okay? That's God's promise to us. So when it rains, what do we often see after it rains? A rainbow. And it's a reminder to the people that after it rained, okay, we're good. Rain's over. There's a rainbow. God didn't forget. He's not going to destroy the earth, okay? It's a shame today that the rainbow means something very, very different today, okay? That's a bummer, right? Because the rainbow was God's sign of a covenant between humanity and himself that he would never, ever again destroy the earth, okay? And when we think rainbow in the 21st century, we think something very different, okay? So that's a sign that we should fight for, I think. Maybe not fight for, but it's a bummer that that means something very different, okay? So with this promise, okay, this covenant that God has established with mankind, what does man have to do for this covenant to take place? Nothing, right? Whose obligation of this is this covenant to keep? God's, and God's alone. I will do these things, okay? It's called a unilateral covenant, like one way, okay? Unicycle, unilateral, okay? It is a one-way covenant. God is saying, I'm going to do these things, okay? Regardless of what you do in return, it doesn't matter, okay? Whether you believe this, whether you respond to this, whether you, you know, make a sacrifice after I do it, I'm still going to do these things. So it's a one-way covenant, okay, that God makes with mankind saying, I promise to do these things. And there is no expected response. There is no condition. There is no, I will do these things if you do these things. It's like, no, I'm going to do these things, okay? So just tuck that away. Again, we'll talk in much more depth about those, but that's one type of covenant in Scripture, okay? Does God make other types of covenants in Scripture where he says, this isn't a I promise to do regardless, but I promise to do if you do in return. If you, then I. Does he make those type of promises in Scripture? Yes. See also the Mosaic Law, okay? Hey, here are a bunch of laws. If you obey them, I will bless you. If you disobey me, what happens? Hands on the chalkboard, okay? And you're going to get a paddle. Okay, that's how it's going to work. We're going to give you licks, okay? And that's a different type of covenant, and God's very clear on which are which, okay? So we're going to get to some bigger covenants in a couple chapters, and we'll walk through those, okay? But this one specifically is a unilateral covenant, a one-way promise, okay? By the way, just since we're here, okay, when you get married, what is it called? What do you make on that altar? A covenant. You don't make a promise, by the way, according to Scripture's language. You make a covenant. Which type of covenant would you guess that it is? An if you, then I, or a one-way covenant? Something to think about, okay? God does not mess around with marriage, okay? Big deal, okay? And he uses a word that he doesn't use a whole lot of places. It is a covenant, okay? So, something to think about. I'll rant on that probably later and raise my voice and pound the table and then move on, okay? So, God sets his bow in the clouds. I will never destroy the earth again. Okay, we're not going to do that. That way, everyone who looks upon the bow will find peace and know that, you know, don't wig out. Okay? Verse 18, the sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Okay, you guys need to remember those names. Three sons that were with Noah beforehand. They were on the ark, and we get three lines that are going to come from them. We'll see that here in just a second. Okay? Verse 20, Noah began farming and planted a vineyard. Okay, so post-flood, now Noah is a farmer. He's making a vineyard, so he makes grapes. What happens when you make grapes? What do you get? You get wine. Verse 20, he drank of the wine and became drunk and uncovered himself inside his tent. Whoops. Okay, so he had a little too much vino one night after dinner, and now he, you know, uncovers himself and is drunk. Okay, now in that culture, to be naked is far more shameful than it is even in our culture. Okay, so just so you guys know, to honor oneself, it's just a bit, you don't leave people naked. It's a shame-based culture, okay? And to do that to someone would create great shame on them. So the fact that Noah is naked is a bad deal, okay? It's shameful to him, okay? So Ham, one of the brothers, happens to see his dad in verse 20, or 22 rather. Read that.
Ham the father came
Okay, so he sees his naked father, who's now shamed himself because of this act. And what does he do? Goes and tells his brothers, right? Like, think junior high. What did he just do? Dude, you gotta see Dad. He's totally ripped. He uncovered himself. That's the idea. He's bragging, in a way, about his father's sin. He's further dishonoring his dad by telling them about his sin. Okay? What could he have done in that situation to covered him, which Shem and Japheth are about to do, or not told his brothers, or something other than, come and look at Dad. You know, that's exactly what he does, okay? Shem and Japheth, watch what they do, 23. So literally, they both take a garment between them, put it on their shoulders, and walk backwards and drop it on Dad. So as to not dishonor their father, okay, to not see his nakedness, to cover him from the shame that he had brought upon himself, okay. So they, in a sense, handle this much better, okay. This doesn't excuse Noah's actions, by the way, and the chapter's, in a sense, a bit weird because we're going to see a curse coming, and it's like, well, what happened to Noah? He's the one that got hammered. Why doesn't he... It doesn't make it right, okay? That's clearly not what God wants. But the consequence of Ham's actions are going to be significant, okay? So Shem and Japheth at least honor their dad, try to handle this correctly. When Noah awoke from his wine, he knew that his youngest son had did to him. So apparently word gets back that Ham had humiliated himself by bragging about or bringing attention to his other brothers as to what they did. So this is what he says, okay? Noah now says in verse 25, read that. Cursed be Canaan. So what line comes from Ham? Verse 25. Canaan, or the Canaanites. Okay, the like forever arch enemy of Israel, the Canaanites, come from Ham. And they are cursed because of Ham's disobedience. Okay, so this people group that comes from Ham is going to get spanked because of their great-grandfather's actions. We still have that line. So God has preserved, okay, so we had Seth, right, that started that after Abel, okay? Then we have Noah, who's from that line. One of his three kids is going to be from that line, okay? It's not Ham. Ham gets cursed, okay? So he gets cursed. Now, they get cursed in the sense that they're not going to be blessed by God in certain ways. But what do we know about the Canaanites? I mean, they're a blessed people in the sense that they are numerous. They are around forever. Okay, they are, God enlarges their land, but they are not the chosen line that God's going to pick. Okay, let's keep reading. Verse 26.
He also said, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem, let Canaan be his servant.
Okay, so what is Canaan going to have to do for Shem? You're his servant. Okay, Shem, by the way, means the name. Okay, it goes Abel, Seth, Noah, Shem. So Abraham is going to come from Shem. So this is now the chosen line of Seth. Okay, the two seeds in the garden, this is the seed of woman. This is the blessed seed of chapter 5. Okay, now Cain is not from that, or I guess they're all from that, but now it's going to part again. And the chosen son of Shem, Ham, and Japheth is Shem. Okay, so God is going to make a name for himself through Abram, who's going to turn into the nation of Israel. And the name is going to start, with Shem. Canaan, or Ham, is forced to be a servant now of Shem. And then watch what else happens with Japheth, who handled this correctly. Okay, so he has to be, Ham, or Canaan, has to be a servant of Japheth as well. Japheth is blessed. Okay, Japheth means to enlarge. Okay, to make bigger. So he's going to get blessed in that his land and his people group is going to get bigger. But what impression do you get in 27? Okay, who gets blessed more, Shem or Japheth? Shem, because Japheth is going to dwell in the tents of Shem. Okay, so the idea is that Shem gets the biggest blessing of them all. Okay, he is the chosen child of the three. Okay, Noah lived 350 years after the flood. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he's going to die. Okay, and then we're going to see in 10 and following the generations that come from that. Okay, so three kids: Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Okay, Ham is going to be the father of the Canaanites. Okay, and we're going to see their story all throughout the rest of our Old Testament, okay? Shem, we can trace Israel ultimately back to Shem, okay? And he's, the chosen line of chapter 5, and then all the way back to Abel, Abel, Seth, Noah, Shem, okay? So that's the line that is blessed, and then Japheth is going to get blessed as well. Chapter 10 is all about kind of those three lines and where they are, okay? So chapter 10, verse 1, in following, these are the generations of Shem. Okay, remember Toledot, here's the outflow. Here are the things that are coming, the generations of each one of these kids that were born to them after the flood. In chapters 10, 2, all the way through 5, we see Japheth. Okay, the Japhethites are going to live primarily to the north of Israel in terms of where they're going to, the land that they're going to occupy. And you see a bunch of names listed. I don't know who half these people are either, so don't necessarily worry about who all comes from this, but you see certain names that are mentioned. They're going to dwell to the north. They're going to be a blessed country, okay? 6 and following, you see now the sons of Ham, okay? And there's kind of a cool story of one of the Hamites in here. Look at verse 8, chapter 10, verse 8, and read that. Okay, so Cush is this guy's dad. His name is Nimrod. Okay, what does Nimrod mean? Anybody got a note on that in their Bible? Nimrod means "let us rebel." Okay, so not a good title, right? So so when you call someone a Nimrod, that's where the name comes from. Okay, it leads "let us rebel." So he's a hunter. Verse 9, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, "Let Nimrod, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord." The beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Does that sound familiar? See also chapter 11. So Nimrod starts a kingdom or a town. Okay, his home base is going to be Babel. More about that here again in a chapter. From that land, verse 11, he went forth into Assyria. Okay, so modern day Assyria that you guys just talked about yesterday. So Assyria, Babylon, and Sumer. Okay, Nimrod is going to be a part of that area. Okay. What else did he build in verse 11? The city of Nineveh. Okay, see also Jonah and all these towns that come from them. Nineveh is the capital land of Assyria for a long time. Verse 13, Mizraim, I guess is that guy's name. That's like Egypt area. Okay, so you're seeing again just the cultures now spreading out, subduing the earth, being fruitful and multiplying. They're doing exactly what God told them. Some are good, some are evil. Again, in verse 18, you see all these people mentioned, and the last family that's mentioned here in 18 are the Canaanites, okay? So again, from the sons of Ham, one of the lines from Ham are the Canaanites, okay? Canaanite extended from Sidon as you go towards Gerar. Okay, Gerar is like modern-day Gaza Strip, kind of down there on the coast of the Mediterranean. Again, I'll show you guys pictures of this, so like if you're like me, I don't know Israel from a hole in my head in terms of the geography of the land. I learned none of this in seminary. So we'll get you guys familiar with kind of the land and why that's important next week, okay? Verse 21 and following is Shem, rather. So this is the godly line that we follow, okay? So we get, again, a list of names here in chapter 10 from Noah. And then in verse 11, or chapter 11, rather, we'll pick up on the story of what's happening throughout the entire earth. Okay, so let's walk through Babel, okay, and let's pause for a second and walk through big picture, okay? Big picture of Genesis, remind me of the theme. Sovereign election, okay? Chapter 1 is about God. Chapter 2, man. Chapter 3, sin or the fall. Chapter 3, 15, redemption. 4 and 5. Civilization's good. 6 through 9, which we just read, is what? Judgment. And then 10 and 11 are about what? Nations, races, in civilization, or nations, races, and pagan religions. Okay, so have we seen more nations rise up? Yes, chapter 10 is all about the nations that come from Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Okay, we got, you know, we've got Jewish folks living in Germany and up north. We got Egypt. We got Assyria. We've got nations forming in chapter 10. Okay, right now, at the beginning of 11, we have different people groups that all speak one language. Okay, and there's a problem with that idea, or at least with that issue, since everyone has the same language. All right, so chapter 11, we're going to see again nations, races, and religions. Okay, 11 verse 1, let's pick up there.
Now the whole earth uses the same language and the same words.
Okay, literally, they use the same words. So when we say dog, everyone said dog. No one said, you know, they didn't have dog in a different language. There was no perro, there was no whatever. Okay, so one language is spoken throughout the earth. Okay, keep going.
It came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of
Shinar. Okay, so this is modern day Babylon. Okay, it came about as they journeyed which direction? East. What did we talk about sometimes with east? Picture of sin. Okay, here we go. Okay, this is a picture of the disobedience of this people and what they're doing. Okay, so they settle in Shinar. Okay, Shinar is, again, modern-day Babylon. So that's, they're east of Israel, east of the Promised Land, which isn't sin, but what they're about to do is. Okay, so what do they do in verse 3?
They said to one another, come and let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they use the bricks for stone, and they use tar for molten.
For mortar. Okay, so there's two different philosophies on what's going on in verse 3. Okay, they're in a land and they're going to now make a, you guys remember the ziggurats that you studied yesterday? They're going to make a place of worship and they're going to say, dude, ours is going to be the awesomest ever. Okay, and they're going to make this huge tower that they're going to erect up to the heavens. It's going to be gigantic. Okay, problem is they use bricks instead of mortar and they use they use brick for stone and tar for mortar. Okay, two philosophies. One is, that's what they had, so that's what they used, right? In Texas, every house in the world is built from brick. Everywhere. We've got brick coming out of our ears. You don't see stucco anywhere. You get to California, everything's stucco. Why is that? Because that's what we have, okay? Now, if you want brick here, you got to pay a pretty penny to find a mason and the materials. It's expensive. In Texas, it's dirty cheap because there are brick quarries everywhere. Okay, so they may have just used what they had available. Okay, we don't have stone, but we've got stuff that we can make into brick, so they use brick. Okay, the picture would be possibly that stone would be better, would be stronger, so maybe they used a less impressive substance. Okay, they're going to make this ginormous tower, but they don't even have stone. They're going to have to use brick. Okay, and instead of using what would imply be better, which would have been mortar, they used tar. Okay, so like Noah did with the boat, he filled it with pitch. May have been the picture of they're trying to build this great structure and they don't even use good quality materials in the sense that it's not that impressive, but they think it is, or they just use what they had. Okay, so it can be taken one of two ways. So either way, we're going to see what God thinks about this structure that they're building. Okay, verse 4, read that.
Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach the heaven. Let us make for ourselves a name, otherwise we will be scattered abroad over the face of the whole.
All right, so before we get into God's commentary, what are they trying to do? Okay, walk me through this. Give me the half-full version. Pretend you don't know anything about Babel, okay? You live on the earth. There's a gazillion different people groups. You all speak the same language, but you have different families. Who are you most likely going to hang out with? Like, if you're on the earth in this day, who are you going to gravitate towards? When you've got a gazillion different people groups and families. The people like you, right? That everyone speaks your language, but you're going to hang out probably with your family. So the Hamites are going to hang out with the Hamites and subdivisions of them. You're going to congregate towards families, okay? So death is now a part of the equation. People die, okay? We have now, you know, people that are food has changed and that meat is on the menu. If you're building cities, what are some of the things that potentially happen in a day and age like this, where violence is now a part of the culture, or at least death has been introduced to it? You send out Joe to go gather bricks or hay or whatever you can use to make bricks, and Joe doesn't come back. What are you fearful of? Being killed. Maybe something happened to him, and maybe it did, right? So to protect yourselves, what would you do? And build a city with what? Walls, okay? A structure that we're safe in, okay? And we're seeing maybe that type of mentality come about with some people groups, okay? And what type of tower apparently do they want to do in verse 4? What do they want to build? Impressive, right? We're going to be the biggest. We're going to be the baddest. We're going to be safe, but we're also going to make a name for ourselves. We're going to be the guy in town. Okay, that's kind of the picture of what's going on here, okay? So verse 5, here's what God thinks about that.
The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which his sons, the sons of men have built.
Now, I'm fully convinced that God has a sense of humor, okay? So you'll see more of that in Scripture, okay? If all good things come from God, sense of humor's good. Just extrapolating, okay? What's funny about verse 5? What did they want to build? A tower that what? Reach the heavens, and what does God have to do? Come down to see it. Oh, yeah, there it is. Got it. Let me come down and take a look, okay? You're so close to heaven, right? So they're trying to build this really impressive structure to impress everyone else around them, to make sure that they were safe, whatever reason it was, and God has to come down to see their puny little tower, okay? Now, this is God's observation, verse 6. All right, so we've got an issue. Okay, God says they all have the same language. Nothing that they purpose to do is going to be difficult for them because they all speak now the same language. Okay, so God says to slow this process of this is not what I want. Okay, so you get the picture that Babel is not the concept that God wants. Competition and building of huge structures and trying to make a name for themselves. God said subdue the earth, spread out, you know, leave. He's going to have to do something to slow this process of evil. This is not a good thing. Okay. Verse 7, this is God's solution.
Come, let us go down there and confuse their language so that they will not understand one another's speech.
So what does God do in verse 7? To confuse their language. What's that? Yeah, he gave us French, which I can't understand and neither can you. And he gave us Hebrew and he gave us German and he gave us whatever. Okay, so now, if I speak English, and Jared, you speak French, and Pete, you speak whatever they speak in New Zealand, Australian-ish, what happens now? Who am I going to gravitate towards? Dude, I can't even understand you. Like, you're speaking Babel. Blah, blah, blah. That's where the word comes from. The word Babel means to confuse, okay? So literally, God babbled their language. He confused it. So each people group is now going to be further subdivided. And instead of now there being the ability to do all things, now there's going to be divisions amongst the people that weren't there to the degree that they were before. So now certainly you're going to congregate towards people that are like you, that speak your language that you understand. And then what else is going to happen as a natural result of that? If you've got subdivided people groups that all speak one language, or now only your group speaks that language and everyone else speaks a different language, what does that bring into the equation? What's that? Say it again. Yeah, there's no unity. A bit of fear about other people because you don't understand them. Now there's, you know, even more. So now they're not worried about reaching, you know, the heavens and building this big monstrosity. Now they're worried about more self-preservation and, you know, taking care of themselves, okay? So now we've got languages clearly introduced, okay? Now, I don't know which ones God created, okay? You know, if you ask a Jewish person, they all spoke Hebrew before this. They say Hebrew is the original language. So when God spoke to, you know, Abram, he spoke Hebrew. And when God spoke to Adam, he spoke Hebrew. I don't know. But you ask Ronan, that's what they think. So I like it. That works for me. Okay. Probably wasn't English. Okay. So we've got this picture. So we certainly have now languages. Now, what happens when you stake a tiger, and you stick one in Siberia, and you stick one in Africa, that are both from the same root? What happens genetically over time? What does that species do? It changes. It adapts to the environment that they're in. So is it possible that you now take a subdivided group of people that has their own languages, and now potentially different races form, different colors of skin, different dialects, different traditions and habits. Okay, are you with me? So God sees this issue and says, man, the evil that these guys can do has no end because they can do whatever they want. I'm going to go down and confuse their language. What is the ultimate purpose of what God is trying to do? This is a divine e-break. He is trying to slow the process of evil because they are about making a name for themselves. This is a selfish act. And God says nothing they do will be impossible. So in order to slow that process of evil, I'm going to confuse their languages. And from that, I believe, came races, came languages, came religions. You start worshiping what's around you, whatever it may be, and that's where these different tendencies come from. It's not evil, okay? It's good. God did this to slow the process of evil. So when you see and hear different languages, when you see different races, when you see different traditions that come religiously, that is how the original purpose was met by God, to slow the process of evil, and it was a blessing, not a curse.
Does it sound like God can use language for like all men at that time, or just people in this area where there was diversity of language? Does that really suck? Like, you're all the way in a different part of the world, you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Mess it up.
Right. I think everybody, but you would understand your family's language, so it's not like you're the only person that's like, German, anybody? No? Sprechen Sie Deutsch? No? Oh. Crud. No. So I think family groups would have had a similar language. So again, you're gonna hang out together and be more isolated. And now there's fear with everyone else around you because you don't understand them. You don't know what they're up to. So they got their eyes off of building a tower and now onto other things. Okay. Does that make sense? So.
How long was this like after the flood? I mean, ish. Like, is there...
I should probably know. Abram's gonna be 2000 BC, this is right before that. So we're going to see a couple generations. I mean, a couple. We're going to see hundreds of years worth, I guess, post-Babel. So we're not talking a ton. The flood was, oh gosh, what did I tell you guys? 4,000? I'm not saying that chart the one day. Anyway, so it's a while after the flood, but on the heels of Abram. Okay? So that's the idea. Okay? So somehow in your theology, you've got to account for, where do we get languages? Where do we get races? How did God do that? Was this an evil thing? Okay. Did God curse Lamech and certain lines of people because they did evil and then other, whatever, colored skins or whatever are bad? Or is this actually something that God did as a blessing to humankind to slow evil and to create different languages and people groups in order that they would not pursue evil to the degree that they could? Okay. See also government. That's ultimately what government is. It's God's divine e-break. Slow down. Quit being so evil, okay? Now there are consequences to sin. That's all it is, okay? So that's kind of my take on it, okay? So I see this as a very positive thing, and that's why God created it, okay? And also adds a ton of diversity and, you know, greatness to it, okay? You with me? So nations, races, and religions we're going to see come from this, okay? So back to verse 7. God goes down, confuses the language. Verse 8 now, the Lord scattered them abroad from all over the face of the earth so that they stopped building the city. So they had, again, drawn to one place. He scatters them throughout the earth. Therefore, that was named Babel. Babel also has a double meaning. Not only does it mean confused, it also means gate of God. It comes from a word that means that. So they're trying to build a gate to God, and God says, no, I'm going to make you speak Babel, okay? Because the Lord confused their language of the whole earth, verse 9, and from there the Lord scattered them over the face of the earth. So that's the end result. So I told you to be fruitful, multiply, and to scatter. You stopped and you built a city. This is not what I want. Clearly it's going to get worse if I don't do something. Now we got languages, races, and religions. Okay? You with me? So, and that puts us now right on the heels of Abram. Okay? So verses 10 through verse 26 of chapter 10, we're seeing now the descendants of Shem. And within Shem, verse 24, we get Nahor, okay? Then we get in 26, Terah. Who's Terah?
Father of Abraham.
And then in verse 26 at the end of it, we're going to see Abram, okay? And we're going to see now their story and their journey that you guys already have some phenomenal insight into. So I expect brilliance from you on next Thursday of what's going to happen with this, okay? So I think now that you guys got the background reading now, God calling Abram out of Ur will make a lot more sense in why God did what he did. Okay? So let's finish there. You guys have a great weekend. Enjoy yourselves. Be safe. And we will see you next Thursday. All right? Peace.